For WFHB in Bloomington, this is Hereabouts,
a collaboration with the IU Asian Culture Center.
Everybody, my name is Ellen Wu. I'm an associate professor of history and the director of Asian American Studies here at IU Bloomington. Welcome to this episode of Hereabouts, Asian American Midwest Radio. And I'm really, really psyched today. I've got a special guest who is my academic sibling, meaning we went to the same graduate school and had the same advisor. Our special guest today is Dr. Meredith Oda, who is associate professor of history at the University of Nevada, Reno. We studied in Chicago. I almost said Chicago. So welcome, Meredith.
Thank you so much. And I'm really excited to talk to Midwesterners. And I should also correct you for if there's any Nevadans listening, it's Nevada. Nevada, not Nevada.
Nevada?
Nevada. You got to flatten that A.
Okay. Well, that's very Midwestern, actually. So welcome back to the Midwest. I'm so sorry that it's been, you know, you hit like the coldest day of the year, I think, so far. So today I thought we could approach our conversation kind of like StoryCorps for history nerds. So because we're both historians, I thought I would ask you a little bit about just who you are, your background, your family, and then how you got into history. And then have you tell us a little bit about the projects that you're working on. Okay, so who are you? What are you? I mean, where are you from is a loaded question, I think, when you ask that to Asians. But maybe because we're both Asian American, I can ask you, where are you from? And where's your family from? And
yeah, because usually I say Philadelphia and they don't believe me. And I say Philadelphia and they don't believe me. And I say Philadelphia and then they walk away. So yeah. So I am from Philadelphia. That's where I was born and spent most of my young life. And then I moved to the Bay Area. So I feel like I'm partly a weird, I don't know, exception by being an East Coast Asian American. Mm-hmm. But then I still have the experience of the West Coast from my high school and my college. And I'm Japanese American. I'm fourth generation. So it's been, I don't know, quite a while, I guess. And three of those generations are from Hawaii. So my parents were both born in Hawaii, and I was born, though, in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, fourth generation JA. So very distant from anything. Whenever people ask me about, oh, do you speak Japanese? No, I don't. I try. I'm learning, but it's terrible.
So your family didn't, you didn't grow up speaking Japanese at home with your
parents? No, no. My parents went to Japanese school when they were kids, mm-hmm. but they didn't, you know, like, well, I don't know. I'm sure your sons actually are going to be fluent Chinese speakers, but my parents were not. But it's funny, actually, I was telling this story to Lee Herrick, the poet, and he was talking about his language. He's a Korean adoptee, and he was talking about how, like, his relationship to the Korean language. And I was talking about my relationship to Japanese, and it's actually, I kind of have a relationship to Japanese because all my family is from Hawaii. There's a lot of Japanese there, and so some Japanese does get retained. Mm-hmm. But when I did meet my first person, actually, from Japan, I thought I would show off with my, you know, like, handful of Japanese words. And so one of the things I said was, I think we're getting into the car. Oh, do you need to go to the benjo? Which in Hawaii means you need to go to the bathroom. Do you need to go to the toilet? And they laughed at me, you know, like, don't say that ever again. You're embarrassing yourself. Because I guess it's something like, do you need to go poo-poo in the potty? Like, it's
like baby Japanese.
Yeah, like, it is Japanese, and they understood it. But it's like, you know, the Japanese that got handed down to me is like immigrant Japanese from the turn of the 20th century. So like it's antiquated, it's also probably like podunk, hick, you know, country Japanese. It's not like polite, nice Tokyo Japanese. So like yes, my relation to Japanese then is like mediated by generations.
Yeah, you know, I've always thought that'd be a fascinating research topic for, like, a linguistic person, because yeah. I had a conversation with another friend who's also fourth-generation Japanese, and she pointed out the same thing, which was the Japanese she grew up with in the household is, like, turn-of-the-century Japanese. And so I think of it like, you know, I learned Cantonese from my mother, who came from Hong Kong to Canada in the 1960s. So my Cantonese is probably like the version of talking like, gee willikers, you know, or just like if some Americans came out of like the 1950s, you know, some like weird hybrid mashup childhood time warp, you know. So I always find that stuff really fascinating, especially with the Japanese American slang, you know, there's so much of it. And it's also regional based on California, Hawaii. Mm-hmm. So how did you get interested in history? Because that's actually not very common for Asian Americans.
Yeah, or there were not that
many. At least a common profession, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not a doctor. I'm not an engineer. Or I am a doctor, but my daughter doesn't believe it because I'm a fake doctor, not like her real doctor. So I attribute it to partly my parents' cheapness and taking us on taking me on vacations when I was young. So we were living in Philadelphia, and so it was easy to go to like Gettysburg or Williamsburg or the Liberty Bell, just like right downtown. So I kind of grew up with a lot of it, and I just really liked it. Like, I loved it. I thought it was super interesting. I'd always, like, daydream about what time period I would want to live in, if I could live in any time period. So I just always, I think it was really the clothes. I really liked, like, kind of old-fashioned clothes. So, yeah, I just kind of, I grew up around it, and it was something I was actually really interested in, but just in a very general fashion until I got to college, until I got to Berkeley. And so I went to Berkeley for my undergraduate, and I took some Asian American studies classes, and that was kind of when I realized, like, oh, actually this is something, like, I don't know, like, it's nice to see yourself in the history, which I wouldn't have I did not see in, you know, growing up in
Colonial Williamsburg.
Yeah. Surprisingly, there are no, like, Chinese migrants being dressed up in Colonial Williamsburg. So it was kind of fun to see myself actually in the history. And I think that was kind of what pushed me over the edge. It was like when I was taking these Asian American studies classes that I realized, like, oh, this is actually something I want to actually do. Like, it's not just like a hobby, but I really like it and I want to study it and write about it.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of studying and writing about it, tell us about your new book. And I want to congratulate you on your new publication, which is called The Gateway to the Pacific. And I'm holding it up here even though you can't see it on the radio. The Gateway to the Pacific, Japanese Americans and the Remaking of San Francisco, which came out very recently by the University of Chicago Press. And it's got this really fantastic cover that features a retro, you know, 1960s era snapshot of the San Francisco Japan Town shopping mall. Yeah, tell us about that.
Yeah, so I came across this topic right after college. So again, I did Asian American studies at Berkeley. I was really interested, and so it's very, in some ways, kind of community-centered because it comes out of that old school kind of like Asian American movement, get people back into the communities, work with our communities. So I interned at a Japanese American Historical Society in Japantown. So I worked in Japantown during and after college, and I just kind of got interested in, like, thinking about, like, why it looks the way it does. So, again, to the audiences at home, you can't see the cover, but it's a mall. It's like a modernist mall from the 1960s, and that is kind of, like, the defining aesthetic. You can't miss it. And that is kind of the predominant place. If you go to Japantown, that is where you would go. You would go to the mall. And so I was just wondering how it got that way, because I also knew from my Asian American history classes that it had been an ethnic enclave, and it had been considered the ghetto of San Francisco. It neighbored the Black community of the Fillmore, and between the two of them, over the course of the 20th century, it got this, as many racialized communities are, the, I don't know, image, I guess, of being a ghetto, of being a place that you would want to escape from, and that also is dangerous for the rest of the city. But so at any rate, I was really interested in how it got from this enclave to this kind of like modernist mall. So I just kind of had that question in my pocket as I went into graduate school. And then when I got into graduate school, I got really interested in urban history. And I really don't know why that was, but it just seemed so fascinating to think about the different reasons that neighborhoods change, how and where people live, like what access they have to municipal or private or whatever resources are around in the community. So kind of that individual level is what really interested me, because that was, to me, really where you would see like actual people figuring out their daily lives and seeing how those daily lives changed because of various larger transformations. So to me, urban history just seemed like a really fascinating study. And there was just this rich literature that we were exposed to, particularly I think at Chicago, where mm-hmm. urban history is or has been particularly robust, or urban studies.
Can I just interrupt just for a minute? When you say urban history, what does that mean for the non-history people?
So it kind of just means studying cities. Like, it just means, like, and it can mean actually, and this is a debate among the profession, like, what exactly does it mean? Does it mean you just study stuff that happens and that happens to be in a city? Or does it mean that you study the way city governments work? Or does mm-hmm. it mean that you study residential patterns. So there is no definitive answer, and people will still probably be fighting about it.
And what counts as a city?
Yeah.
So you can study the suburbs. Is that urban history? Or
yeah, or like it's a metropolitan region. Like, so would you study the Bay Area as urban history? Or would you study, like, could you study, I don't know.
College town.
Like a small college town, like Bloomington, would that be a city? And like by census definitions, that would be. But of course, by what we might sort of popularly imagine as a city, like we might think of like New York City or Chicago or Los Angeles, all of which are very different kinds of cities too, right? Roughly, it means studying cities, however you want to decide them. Yeah, however you want to define them. And to me, it really is about engaging kind of, to me, I think about it, and this is why I was so interested in it, is because it's about thinking about things on a local, everyday level and thinking about them in their context. So, like, it's important that city infrastructure is the way it is, or that neighborhoods look the way they do, or people live where they do and not in other places where they don't have access. So that sort of granular level, I think, is what was really interesting to me, the sort of local context.
So give us like the, you know, snapshot, the quick run through of the layout, the architecture, if you will, of your book. What is the story that you kind of map through the different chapters?
So yeah, what I'm really interested then is, I mean, so in the most basic level, it is about changes in San Francisco's Japantown from like after World War II, so from about 1945 until about 1972, or yeah, like late 60s, early 70s. And a lot of that change, as I realized, is because of the ways in which kind of municipal government, civic identity, and the city's economy was changing. So, and this was kind of a surprise to me. So I thought originally, like, I went into it thinking, like, this is going to be a micro history of Japantown. I'm just going to look at, like, how it changed over time, how the buildings fell and other buildings got erected, where people lived and where they moved to. But it quickly became apparent to me that in order to understand that, there was this much larger framework. And that framework actually extended across the Pacific and into Japan. So I had to understand, you know, Japanese domestic retail regulations or foreign relations between the U.S. and Japan, because, as it turns out, San Francisco was enamored with Japan and the larger Pacific region starting from, say, the end of the 1940s through the 1960s. And it was because the city kind of saw itself as being what it called itself, the gateway to the Pacific. It saw itself as this West Coast gateway between the United States and Japan in particular, but the larger region more broadly. And so because of that, it kind of, the city and city leaders worked to reshape city institutions, worked to like create new celebrations around kind of the city's relationship to these other places. But one of the most important, and I think one of the most kind of consequential ways in which, you know, cities, what might seem like an abstract kind of identity of like a sort of Pacific orientation, ended up really hitting the road is through transformations in buildings and streets and infrastructures. And so the Japan Center in San Francisco is one of, is the example of that that I use. So I kind of follow the building of this, who helped to build it, why, where people came from to help build it, where the money came from, but also just how it was kind of conceived of and sort of understood by the various people involved, like the Japanese Americans who lived in the neighborhood, or like the African Americans who also lived in the neighborhood, or city officials, or even Chinese Americans who are also, you know, the sort of multiracial texture of the multiracial population of the city, sort of looking at this one particular place and seeing all sorts of different interests and motivations behind it.
Yeah, so when you were just kind of telling us about the overarching kind of trajectory of this story, what really struck me when you said, you know, San Francisco was, the city of San Francisco was enamored, in your words, with Japan, beginning in the late 1940s. And that is so striking, obviously, yeah. I think, because the entire country had just fought this war against Japan locked away 120-some thousand Japanese Americans who were living in California and Oregon and Washington. So that in itself is really just jumps out. And I thought maybe you could explain, was it just, was the enamoring with Japan all of a sudden, it's like, oh, this opportunity, you know, we've like destroyed Japan, but now the U.S. is going to rebuild it in, as a junior partner in the Cold War and kind of refashion its economy. So was it just about Japan as this like cash cow? Or, you know, what is the motivation? Is it about attracting capital? And then And then I guess my other question would be the very sort of strategic and interesting role of Japanese Americans, these folks that you call brokers, right? Big business people and the architects and community members, all of whom in some ways I think fashion themselves as experts on Japan to, yeah, sort of, I don't want to say cash in, but kind of take advantage of this moment and this larger citywide interest in forging, you know, a stronger ties with Japan.
Yeah, and I think both of those two things are, I mean, obviously they're very interconnected. So San Francisco, the city leaders got really interested in Asia more broadly following World War II. And it was really maybe by the early 1950s, mid-1950s, that suddenly it became all about Japan. And there's a number of reasons for this. And then also a number of things that have to be kind of put aside in order to get there, right? So on the one hand, it is. Like, there's just a lot of sort of hard-knuckle economic interest going on. And there is a sense that after World War II, right, this was a war that we fought in the Pacific theater, you know, millions of Americans cycled through that in one way or another, either fighting, serving in the occupation, working as business people or as diplomatic representatives. And so for the first time, really, and this is something that other scholars have shown, like, Americans really have this newfound interest in the region, right, that they just didn't necessarily have before. There was no investment, no American blood being there was, obviously, there has been in the Philippine-American War and whatnot, but nonetheless, not on a large scale. You don't see, like, this large-scale investment in the Pacific as you do because of the Pacific War and then the American occupation of Japan afterwards. And so for the first time, really, we have a lot of attention, but that also means, I mean, along with all of those people going back and forth across the ocean, there's also just a lot of actual networks being developed and also new business opportunities that people are seeing in Asia. Like, this is now a developing market because of U.S. policy and Cold War policy. Asia is really very important, right? It could be, if sort of properly allied with or maybe sort of properly domesticated as a junior partner, as you say, then it could serve as this really important bulwark against Russia, right? This is the sort of swath of the globe that stands between the United States and Russia. And it could also serve as valuable allies, particularly as these countries decolonize. And so there's sort of simple geopolitical, I guess, attention that is both political but is also economic. Just all these markets untapped, this huge population untapped by American businesses, and specifically in San Francisco businesses, because there is this long-standing transportation and commercial net link between Japan and San Francisco. So it's partly that. But then it gets complicated by the fact that China is taken away as a trading partner, right, after the Chinese Civil War, and the U.S. kind of quote-unquote loses China. And so now that market, which is something that for so long, right, American business people have been looking at as this golden opportunity, right? If we could just get into China and those, like, billions of people will make a fortune. So that partly helped to shift attention to Japan, to this other place that, because, again, of American policy, like, all these American dollars, servicemen are, like, just heading into Japan, spending money and helping the economy, intentionally helping the economy sort of grow, right? Again, to serve as this kind of capitalist bulwark in the Pacific, to kind of cement alliances with these other countries in Asia. So there's just this sort of foreign policy, sort of foreign relations context going on that San Francisco business people in particular are really attuned to. They're really attentive to this because they see themselves as direct beneficiaries of Japan's rise if they can make sure they properly, I guess, capture that market. And part of that means forging economic ties, but part of it also means having personal ties, like making sure that you as a business partner are known to your potential business partner in Japan as a ready ally, as someone who's interested not just in your money, but also like in your culture and in your people and any way in which you can make these sort of extra commercial ties. You know, business people are very interested in that. And so they do things like create a sister city program with Osaka and other sort of cultural efforts to kind of make it, I don't know, you know, like, so that it doesn't seem like you're just out for your own interest, but like, no, I'm really interested in you. Like, tell me about yourself. No, please, right? So because, you know, so this is a way to kind of buttress their sort of economic interests, but couching them in these larger sort of social, personal, cultural relations. So those kind of help business leaders, I think, kind of you know, overlook some of the very recent hostilities. And because it's cultural, because it's very cultural in nature, or what the kinds of relationships they're trying to build are very cultural in nature, like through the sister city ties, like through student exchanges or exchanges of artwork or cultural displays, right? They're also, those are useful because they help to show not only Japanese counterparts, look, we're interested in you, but also they can show participation, popular participation in San Francisco, right? Because thousands of people can come out to a parade or thousands of people can go to a display in the De Young Art Museum and show like how interested all San Franciscans are. So it's partly kind of just economic interest, but then it also becomes this kind of much larger cultural interest, again, kind of for economic reasons, but in ways that help to capture popular imagination. Again, which seems kind of weird considering how recently the two countries are fighting. Like it is, and so because of that, these cultural tools, I think, become more important because they are ways of sort of like humanizing what had been seen as a very demonic, alien, hated enemy. And then for your second question about Japanese Americans, so they become very important too, right? So part of the problem is, and this is also part of the war, as some historians have shown, that Americans just thought of Japanese people as being very different, right? Like, so during the war, they were brutal and superhuman perhaps, but animalistic and like hated and just...
Like different in a bad way.
Different in a bad way, but just fundamentally different. And that continued even into the sort of more friendly period in which there were still assumptions that, oh, they're still very different. Like, we had this business conversation and the guy kept nodding, but then he walked out and we didn't make a deal. Like, so there's still a lot of what business people in America think of as enormous cultural sort of misunderstandings and cultural gaps or divides. And so Japanese Americans, the ones who are particularly set up for this, or are able, for reasons of language training, often developed in the war, in their wartime service, or through, I don't know, maybe aesthetic or artistic knowledge, are able to make claims for being particularly knowledgeable about Japan. They're able then to carve out sort of roles as brokers, as intermediaries between American interests and Japan, able to sort of step into what white Americans saw as this gaping divide between them and their Japanese counterparts and say, oh, let me interpret this for you. I can tell you what's going on here. Like, this is what's going on with Japanese design. This is how we can incorporate it in different ways into American buildings. Or this is what the business people mean when they say this. They're really just trying to save face, and so they're trying to do this. And ironically, that wouldn't have been possible for these Japanese Americans if there hadn't been, in fact, very real connections between Japan and the United States that allowed them to sort of build on what was already a kind of pre-existing set of perhaps stereotypes, sets of ideas about Japanese, like, oh, they like to save face, or, oh, they're going to be very obscure, oh, they're never going to get a direct answer out of them. And so because there is, in fact, quite a lot of pre-existing knowledge about Japan, correct or not, Japanese Americans are able to kind of capitalize on that, and for some, able to make quite a good living out of that as legal representatives, as sign interpreters, I guess, or as financiers and developers mediating between Japanese investment and American projects.
Right. In some ways, it's like a very strategic, like, it's like a, not racial profiling exactly, but it's like, I'm going to take these assumptions that mainstream society has about Japan and Japanese people, and because I have a so-called Japanese face or name, I'm gonna build a career or, you know, make some money or whatever, you know?
Yeah, because the
and
funny
become
thing
an
is,
influencer.
Yeah, so. I'm like a social media influencer
yeah.
now. Because a lot of these people didn't necessarily have, it's not like this is inherent knowledge, like you don't grow up thinking like,
right.
I know everything, you know, like it's not in the blood, right? Instead, a lot of them actually learned it when they were serving in the army and the army taught them Japanese so they could serve as in a war to fight Japan, okay. So that they could serve as interpreters with the Japanese enemy. And that was like, but they had to train these people because they didn't know how to speak Japanese. Like, they had gone to Japanese school, I guess, like my parents did, and knew nothing. And so, you know, like, they actually had to be really trained in order to live up to these expectations. But because those expectations were there, they're able to kind of move into them. And then also, like, so it does seem kind of, I don't know, opportunistic, but in some ways, too, and I think this is where maybe the internment fits in, or the incarceration in World War II fits in, because, you know, for most of these, either they or their families had been interned. And so I think any avenue towards inclusion or opportunity, right, anything that perhaps it is amplifying differences or accentuating some sort of racial difference, but nonetheless it is offering an opportunity for inclusion or belonging in some ways that might have seemed very attractive if you had just recently, like 10 years before, been incarcerated for being Japanese.
Right. Among a set of limited choices before you, you know, and behind you,
like the best.
This is kind of is very attractive. Mm-hmm. It could be very attractive. Mm-hmm. That totally makes sense. So yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it's a great book, and you can find Gateway to the Pacific by Meredith Oda at any fine bookseller on the internet, or even places like City Lights in San Francisco or the Seminary Co-op in Chicago. I just want to say ask you to talk just a little bit about the new project you're working on right now.
So when I was researching this book, I have a little bit, and I should just say I hopefully didn't make it too boring, but I try to have, there's a lot of people in it. So part of that was what was interesting to me. And that's also what's part of what's interesting about urban history is that it's all about the people, and you can actually get to know them because, you know, if you're looking at a city, there's not that many of them. But at any rate, one of the things that I found so interesting was that I was trying to figure out for the first chapter, what happens when people return from the incarceration camps back to, in this case, San Francisco. And I just found that there was so little written. It was really difficult to build a story, and it wasn't the central part of my research. I couldn't spend a ton of time figuring out exactly what's going on, and it just made me really interested in what happens. Where do people go when they leave the incarceration camps? Where do they go? How do they make a living? How do they settle into communities? Until 1945, people could leave the camps, but they couldn't return to the West Coast, so they had to go to Chicago or Cleveland or some small farm in a podunk town in central Pennsylvania or something, right? And so I was just curious about, so how do they go there? How do they end up there? How do they find it? What kinds of jobs do they find? Where do they live? How do they like it? What do they feel like when they're the only Japanese person now, after having grown up in little Tokyo and LA, suddenly, it's just them. So, that was really interesting to me. So where are people going and how are they living? And so a lot of that involves kind of people accessing community centers, federal agencies for help or direction, social welfare services in the various communities that they're moving into. And that seemed very interesting to me too, one, because there was a lot of services intended to help resettlers so that they don't just end up afloat and possibly making the relocation or resettlement program look bad. So they get a lot of assistance, and that's interesting because this is a scale of assistance that even a lot of citizens don't have. And then what also is interesting to me is the fact that a lot of these, not a terribly large number of resettlers during the war, but a number of them are in fact aliens. Japanese migrants can't naturalize. They can't become citizens if they wanted to until 1952. So on the one hand, they're legal aliens, and on the other hand, they're accessing a lot of benefits, rights, and responsibilities of citizens, but doing so in these local small communities. So that's what my project is looking at, where people are going and what it means particularly for people who are not citizens.
I can't wait to read it. I think it sounds awesome.
Thanks.
So excited for you. This is a great topic and a needed one in our, historical research. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Meredith Oda, for joining us today on Hereabouts. It was a lot of fun to geek out with you on Asian American history and to hear about your research and your writings, and we wish you lots of luck on your new project.
Thank you so much for having me. It's so great to talk to you.
You've been listening to Hereabouts with the IU Asian Culture Center, broadcast by WFHB in Bloomington. Our theme music is by Eternal Youth. Tune in to Hereabouts every Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m.